Law, Policy, and Markets. I'm Alan Marks. Today I'm joined by Catherine Fell, a litigator and partner at Milbank based in New York.
The deaths in custody at Rikers Island over the past approximately 2 years are the highest that they have been since the early 90s, and it does not seem to be slowing down.
Let's get to it. The United States Supreme Court ruled nearly 50 years ago that a prison staff's deliberate indifference to the serious medical needs of prisoners is cruel and unusual punishment, forbidden by the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The Constitution does not guarantee comfortable prisons, but incarcerated persons are legally entitled to an acceptable standard of care in terms of modern medicine and beliefs about human decency. People in jail lose their liberty, but not basic rights like food, shelter, and access to needed medical treatment. State and local rules likewise require minimum standards of medical care. The city jails in New York are falling short of that minimum standard, with thousands of inmates at Rikers Island and other city jails routinely deprived of adequate medical care. Delaying or interfering with access to treatment has too often resulted in physical injury, severe pain, and even death of people in the city's custody. This is a complex situation and not just a matter of money. Basically, with bail reforms and falling crime rates, the city's jail population dropped dramatically for the 15 years through 2020. The budget for the Department of Corrections has fallen too, though not as quickly, resulting in sharply higher spending per prisoner. Since 2021, however, the jail population is growing again due to bail reform rollbacks, processing backlogs increasing jail stays, and more gun crimes. For the past 5 years, attrition and absences among corrections officers have skyrocketed, and replacement hiring has not kept up with the rebounding jail population. As a result, the Department of Corrections' own reports show that the number of incarcerated people needing medical treatment who are not produced each month rose from about 2,000 to over 15,000 just in the year from summer 2020 to summer 2021. The bottom line is that the jails are broken. The staffing shortage is massive, and inmates are losing access to critical medical care in violation of the law. Here to talk about ongoing litigation to remedy the situation is Catherine Fell, a litigator and partner at Milbank in New York. Catherine, thanks very much for taking the time to get together today.
Thanks so much for having me, Alan. I'm excited to be on the podcast and talk about this case.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. And this case, Agnew versus the New York City Department of Corrections, has been going on for some time, and the facts are quite dramatic. But before we get to the case, I just want to set the stage. The prison population in New York City is quite large, and it's a responsibility, of course, of the government to provide at least a constitutional level, if not a higher level, of medical care for the incarcerated population for whom it's responsible. How did you get involved in this case?
So in the fall of 2021, the Legal Aid Society reached out to us, and they had been hearing from their clients who were incarcerated on Rikers Island that increasingly they were not getting access to medical care, and the Legal Aid Society felt that it had reached a fever pitch level. And there was some public reporting data that bore that out. In fact, the levels in summer of 2021 of people whose medical appointments were missed due to DOC's sort of own failure to provide an escort or mismanagement were in the realm of 5,000 instances a month, which is pretty significant because the population of Rikers at that time was about between 5 and 6,000. So the number of appointments being canceled per month was equal to, you know, at least one per person in the facility. And obviously that meant in reality, that meant for the critically ill that they were having appointments canceled over and over again. And so they reached out to us to partner in an action to remedy this situation. And we worked together to fashion an Article 78 proceeding in New York State Court, seeking an order of mandamus, directing the Department of Corrections to comply with their pre-existing duties under the law, as you noted, under regulations and state law, to provide this access. And so that's what we did in October of 2021.
And of course, prisoners have lots of different medical needs. Some have injuries while they're in custody. Others have chronic health conditions. Obviously, there are suicides and drug overdoses and other things that even within the walls of a prison can still be a serious issue. How do prisoners ordinarily, if the system was working right, how do they obtain medical care?
They are dependent on corrections officers to get them to medical care. So the medical care in the jails is provided by a separate agency, Correctional Health Services. But the way the Department of Corrections gets its people in its custody to those appointments is by providing escorts, who are correctional officers, who go to the housing blocks, and they will pick up someone who has a medical appointment, and they will escort them down to the clinic. They will also escort them to a bus or a shuttle to an outside provider or a specialist appointment. And that is the way DOC has their system set up. But in 2020, starting in 2020, at the height of the pandemic, the Department of Corrections started having exceedingly high numbers of staff call out sick. And under the collective bargaining agreements with the correctional officers in New York City, they had unlimited sick leave. And in the face of the pandemic, there was a surge of absenteeism. So it was correctional officers who were calling out sick repeatedly without cause. It was not because they had COVID. It was because they didn't want to come to work for a variety of reasons, including exposure to COVID. And this caused a near collapse in jail services. And one of the first things to go was the escort system. So these people were in critical pain in a lot of instances, had wounds, were very ill, were making appointments with CHS. They were scheduling the appointments and no one was ever arriving to bring these people to medical care. So they were stuck, locked in their cells without any access to care.
So as a result, when you went to the court in 2021, the court did two things. One, they agreed and they had a finding that the city's Department of Correction was in fact improperly denying access to medical care for the incarcerated population. The other thing they did is they certified a class and named Milbank along with the Brooklyn Defender Services and the Legal Aid Society as the counsel to the class. What does that mean in practice?
So that was a critical finding. The court ordered the Department of Corrections to comply with its obligations under the law to provide regular and timely access to medical care and certified a class. And the effect of that was that it precluded the Department of Corrections from mooting out our claim by just taking the individual class representatives on the complaint to their scheduled medical appointments and leaving the rest of the population out in the cold. And that was a very significant win for us, in part because under New York state law regarding class actions, there's something called the government operations rule, which functions as a presumption against class certification in an injunctive relief case, because it's presumed that the government, if it changes its policies or procedures, that it will apply equally to everyone, which is a presumption that makes sense in some contexts and one that doesn't in others. We were able to convince the court here that it didn't make sense to apply the government operations rule for a number of reasons, including that an order of mandamus is actually not a injunctive relief action. It's more of a declaratory. Mandamus is sort of its own breed, but it's more of a declaratory relief. And so that was distinguishing from other cases. And I think that the court was persuaded that this was a crisis in the jails and was not interested in creating any opportunity for the government to evade really solving the problem.
So, of course, then the Department of Corrections must obviously have done the right thing. Everything was good. They came back a week later and said what a wonderful job they were doing, or did something else happen?
Unfortunately, that's not where the story ended. It's almost too easy, I know, to get an order, finding that they were not complying and that they needed to comply. It was actually interesting through that process. There was an initial hearing on our mandamus petition, and the Department of Corrections raised the defense of impossibility. And they said because of COVID-19 that it was actually impossible to comply with their obligations to provide regular and timely access.
So I want to pause on that for a second, because if indeed there's absenteeism and a problem with DOC employees not coming to work, and there is a pandemic raging, and obviously they only have limited funds and limited skilled employees, was it possible for the DOC to have complied and with its, you know, this minimum legal standard of medical care for the incarcerated?
Yeah, it's a very good question. On the one hand, you know, you hear about absenteeism and you hear about all these people calling out sick and there's this collective bargaining agreement and, you know, what can they do on the one hand? On the other hand, it's quite a bold thing to say we have 60,000 people in our custody and we're not going to provide them access to medical care because we can't. The two are sort of irreconcilable concepts. But at the hearing on the impossibility defense before we won the petition and obtained the mandamus order, we were able to demonstrate that it was not just mass absenteeism. And really what the Department of Corrections was saying was almost like a force majeure type argument, was that it was COVID-19. It was the COVID-19 pandemic and people were legitimately out sick. And that was causing the strain irrespective of the absenteeism. But we were able to show through cross-examination of their witnesses that the rates of absenteeism were not going up and down with surges of COVID-19 in the city. We were also able to show that the department had failed to take other reasonable steps to counteract the problem, such as reassigning non-inmate facing staff to serve as escorts or a pilot program, which they employed after we filed our lawsuit in more of the minimum security housing blocks, allowing people to go to medical care without an escort. And there were a number of other things that they were not doing, including enforcing the rules on absenteeism and incentivizing people to get back to work. And the court concluded that the absenteeism was really not the sole cause of the issue and that DOC had failed to respond with other reasonable measures and with respect to absenteeism specifically, had failed to sort of use all the tools in its toolbox to get people back to work. So we overcame that defense. And that was very helpful because going forward, unfortunately, as you previewed before, DOC did not comply. And so it has been important that we've developed that record on the things that they are not doing for purposes of subsequent contempt proceedings.
Right. So your February motion of 2022 that the department was in contempt of the court order and was not following it and actually admitted many of the ways in which they were not following it did lead to the first contempt order from the court that May. And what's the consequence of a contempt order? If the DOC is first found not to be doing the right thing and then doesn't follow or ignores the court order to do the right thing, so they're in contempt of court, what's the practical consequence of that to DOC and to inmate care?
You know, there are a number of consequences. For a contempt order, the penalties associated with a contempt finding in New York State are generally limited to fines or imprisonment. In connection with our February contempt order, we asked for fines. There is a statute in New York State that allows for a fine of up to $250 for a contempt of a court order that results in a prejudice to an individual's rights.
That $250 is it? It's not just for the whole system. It's $250 either per inmate or per missed appointment or per something.
It's per violation of the order. And it can be $250 or you can prove the damages to the individual. So there's sort of this de minimis penalty of up to $250 or you could prove sort of injury to an individual.
What's the total exposure then to the DOC from the aggregation of those fines?
In the first contempt order, the total exposure was about $200,000. The court ordered not the maximum of $250, but a $100 penalty per violation of the order, which was about 2,000 times over the course of December and January following the 2 months following the order. So the first contempt finding required DOC to pay $200,000 in fines and also to pay the attorney's fees associated with the contempt motion, which was another significant sum. So it was a significant penalty to DOC. There is another interesting aspect of the New York judiciary law on civil contempt fines, which is that if the penalty is assessed based on prejudice to an individual's rights, it's payable directly to the individual affected. So the February contempt motion resulted in an award of $100 per person who was denied access payable to the people in custody who were denied access to medical care during those 2 months.
And so as a result of that contempt order, has the situation improved?
Unfortunately, not significantly. We have seen some improvement in the publicly reported numbers about individuals who are accessing care. But what we've also seen is that, so the Department of Corrections is required to report data on the people who were not able to access medical care each month and categorize the reasons why. And prior to this lawsuit and the first contempt order, there was a category of other, which included no escort and a few other sort of de minimis categories. So the other category was principally no escorts, and those were the numbers we were using in the litigation. Immediately following our first contempt motion, DOC started disaggregating the other category into additional categories and splitting up the data and arguing that actually the other category was overbroad and that not all instances of noncompliance that fell into the other category were their fault. So there was slicing and dicing up the numbers. So we brought a second contempt motion recently arguing that DOC continues to be in noncompliance for the majority of 2022 and that this slicing and dicing of numbers should be seen for what it is. You know, it's just slicing and dicing of numbers. And actually, there hasn't been much improvement. And that motion is currently under consideration.
And if I understand from the papers that were filed for that motion, over 12,000 cases of inmates being denied care have occurred just in February to October of 2022. And 21 people have died while in custody. Maybe not all of them, but certainly a significant portion of them directly connected to a denial of access to medical care in a timely fashion. Those are pretty bad numbers.
They're terrible. The deaths in custody at Rikers Island over the past approximately 2 years are the highest that they have been since the early 90s, and it does not seem to be slowing down. It's approximately one death per month. The causes of death are obviously, there are a lot of things that go into why these individuals are dying, but it is becoming increasingly apparent that lack of access to medical care is a contributing factor in ways that are sometimes difficult to see, but you know, through our work have become quite apparent to us. So for example, a lack of staff causing, you know, a B officer, there's an A officer and a B officer on the housing block ordinarily. Prevalence of lack of B officers on the housing block. So when there's an emergency, like one gentleman actually choked on his housing block, and there was only one officer, and the officer was not able to leave the housing block to take the individual to medical care. And what ultimately ended up happening is the other inmates carried him they were released from the block and carried him to medical services. And he unfortunately did not make it in time and died. So this mismanagement and understaffing problem that they still, you know, notwithstanding that COVID has abated, notwithstanding that it's one of the most well-funded jails in the country, this failure to rectify the staffing and this mismanagement of the staff that they have is continuing to cause grave results by preventing or delaying access to care.
So as a policy matter, and obviously there are other instances where this has been, well, there are other instances where denial of access to medical care has been prevalent in fairly large prison systems or in city jails. You know, the first step is to bring the litigation that you've brought. Second step maybe is to have a class action. Now with contempt orders, if there's a recurring problem where there's no other choice perhaps but to have a receivership or some court-appointed transfer of control of just that discrete function of providing access to medical services, I mean, it's a fairly rare thing to do. I know there's a federal statute from 1995 that makes it fairly challenging to do receiverships. You know, in California, though, we have had significant success actually under court jurisdiction of taking over from the state government in that case with respect to state prisons to improve the function of providing access to medical care. I know that in the District of Columbia, the city jail was under a receivership, and because that's federal, it's interesting. It's very bipartisan. There was a committee that was had oversight of it because I used to work on the Hill, and I was surprised. I mean, some of the strange bedfellows you find supporting care basic medical care in prisons. You've got Dan Burton, who was Republican from Indiana, became part of the Tea Party. You've got on the Republican side, Paul Ryan, who was not yet Speaker of the House, and Joe Scarborough, back when he was a Florida congressman on the Republican side, not a TV personality. Bernie Sanders was on the committee, Henry Waxman, you know, leading Democrat. A lot of people have said, look, there is a basic constitutional requirement at the federal level, aside from state laws, that says if you put someone in custody, you're responsible for their medical care and you can't deny it. Is a receivership or some other kind of extraordinary remedy perhaps going to be necessary if the New York Department of Corrections can't get their act together on this?
Yes, potentially. And we are, you know, just one lawsuit in a broader fabric of lawsuits who are sort of all angling towards this issue, which is if they can't run Rikers Island in a humane and constitutional and appropriate way, that something major is going to have to change. And this has been a topic of conversation. There's a lawsuit by the name of Nunez, which there's an ongoing monitorship of Rikers Island. It was originally a excessive force case, but has sort of become a broader oversight mechanism over the jails. And recently, the Nunez monitor and public officials and have been engaging in a dialogue about a potential receivership. And it's very much part of the conversation. I think it is very challenging, as you mentioned, legally to impose that. From a civil litigation perspective, you know, that really needs to happen on the federal level. From a civil litigation perspective, it's exceedingly difficult to bring civil litigation on behalf of people in custody in federal courts because of the PLRA, Prison Litigation Reform Act, which has very extensive exhaustion requirements, which also applies in state law in a lot of respects. So there are a lot of impediments to getting there, but I think it's a testament to how bad things have gotten at Rikers that's part of the conversation.
When I was in law school, a very good friend of mine was getting her PhD at the law school. And she was focusing on the impact of receiverships and judicial oversight under consent decrees as well. So also looking at law enforcement, not just prisons and things. But she looked at prison healthcare and the impact that had on accountability and governance. Because on the one hand, you've got a bureaucracy which is completely failing. But on the other hand, you've got a kind of a receiver who can do almost whatever they want under the court's auspices, not really mindful of what it costs. And yeah, you could improve it if you get a blank check, and they have a blank check, and so they improve it. But it's, you know, and sometimes it can go for years, and there's a question in a democracy as to, well, is that really accountable? It's a really interesting topic.
Yeah, it's so complicated, and the system it's just so expensive. I mean, they spend something like $500,000 a year on each person in custody at Rikers, and you know, so we have these fines that are $200,000 or $300,000, and it seems like a lot, but it's just not. And so, you know, I think that the economic incentives don't always work out appropriately. And, you know, the receiverships, exactly, they are very expensive. It's like, you know, it's like independent consultants and other sort of civil litigation. Bringing in a foreigner to redo things doesn't always spell long-term success. So it's really difficult. And I think, you know, as a policy matter, and I think my personal opinion, why you see bipartisan support for it is, you know, people often think about prisons in terms of the rights that people are losing when they are incarcerated. So, you know, they're principally their liberty. But the reality is, as a legal matter, they retain most all other rights when they're incarcerated. And when, you know, the concept of custody, we think about taking someone to custody, we think about depriving them of the right. But the reality is you're taking them into custody, which means that the prisons are assuming a responsibility for providing those many, many rights that the individuals in custody retain. And that there's a recognition under the law, under tort law, and a lot of other concepts that custodial relationship provides a special relationship with the prisons that requires them to provide and protect in a way that doesn't exist outside that relationship. And I think when you think about custody in that way, in terms of these people are in the custody and under the care of the Department of Corrections, it helps you understand why these obligations exist, because we've deprived them of their liberty, which means they can't go to the doctor, which means, you know, they can't call up a lawyer or walk down the street and talk to someone. So we have to provide that access to those constitutional rights for them. The other sort of if you dial out in terms of healthcare in the prisons and think about how we care for people in the country more broadly, our healthcare system, there is this service that the prisons are providing in terms of physical and mental health care for a certain section of the population. We all know that our healthcare system in the United States is not the most equal and accessible and affordable system. And there's also this issue that we have regarding mental health care, which 30 or 40 years ago, there were, you know, mental institutions, which we closed principally because of civil abuses related to people being involuntarily committed, which was a problem and, you know, is the reason that they really no longer exist. But without those facilities and without a well-funded and, you know, equal access to healthcare more broadly, a lot of mental health care and a lot of people with health problems end up getting shuttled through the criminal justice system. And so these jails are filling that gap in some respects. Unfortunately, that's the way we're handling it. But I think politicians on both sides of the aisle and many practitioners and lawyers understand that.
Yeah, I can see three things overlapping, right? The denial of the shuttering of mental health facilities, criminalizing of drug abuse, just possession and use. I mean, obviously dealing should be a criminal offense, right? But you put those two together with a housing shortage, and guess what? You've got too many people in jail kind of for not very good reasons. It costs you way too much. And as a taxpayer, you're kind of pissed that you're paying all this money for a system that doesn't work very well.
Yeah. But it's honestly probably our best funded agency for serious mental health and drug problems for, you know, a population who otherwise can't afford specialized treatment, which is really sad, right? It's just, I mean, sometimes going through the criminal justice system ends up improving someone's life just because they can access those services. And it, you know, that's just not the way it should be. And a failure to think creatively, I think about drug treatment too. You know, I think about all of the hand-wringing over like the safe shooting centers where they can, you know, exchange clean needles and you know, get access to treatment, and how still in light of all of this evidence that we've seen about how our you know, handling of the drug crisis has gone so terribly, people are still so offended by the idea. And it's like, we have to think creatively. We have to do these things. We have to take chances because what we're doing is crazy.
So if you look at that policy, I want to stay with you on that for a minute, because really it's fascinating to me. So you have this, I'm going to call it intersectionality, right, between criminal justice, physical and mental health, certainly drug abuse and dependency issues, which overlap quite a bit with people being unhoused or having mental health distress. And the burden placed then on, in this case, the Department of Corrections to meet basically social needs, as well as not being guilty of cruel and unusual punishment in violation of, you know, the U.S. Constitution, you know, Eighth Amendment, as well as meeting the requirements of New York state law, and also just basic humanity. I mean, obviously, you can't put somebody in a city jail, many of whom actually are still waiting further processing and may not even have been convicted of anything just yet. You can't deprive them of food. You can't deprive them of, you know, emergency medical care and so forth. Do you see a prospect in New York City of a larger solution to this politically? You've mentioned it's in a very expensive system already, perhaps also a solution which is not just more humane and more effective, but also more efficient. Or is that just, you know, too idealistic in this day and age?
I don't think it's too idealistic. And in my personal opinion is we have to focus on decarceration. We have to reduce the prison populations. We have to think very hard about how we can do that consistent with other priorities and policies. But you will hear even, you know, people in the prison system and politicians who, you know, on further to the right talk about decarceration now. And I think it in some ways it's a bipartisan goal. And it's very expensive, and it's little things like bail reform and cash bail, but it's also thinking, you know, taking a hard look, I think, at our drug laws and also looking at our social support systems outside of the criminal justice care, being more creative about, you know, addressing drug problems, you know, the opioid epidemic and other issues like that, mental health, providing those services, because in a lot of ways we use the criminal justice system as a blunt tool to get people that help. And we really shouldn't have to usher them through the criminal justice system if they can be assisted, preferably before they get anywhere close to the criminal justice system. But you know, in close cases where, you know, instead of prosecuting or prosecuting to the fullest extent, that we can usher people into a more supportive healthcare treatment program, we can avoid some of this issue. And at the moment, we are not focused on decarceration. There was a big push at the beginning of COVID to reduce the jail population, and they did so successfully at first, and then it popped right back up. It in fact exceeded pre-COVID levels within a very short period of time. So it's clear that we can do it when we really want to, and we need to start focusing on how to do it and how to do it long-term in a way that's sort of consistent with our values and good for society.
Right. And so lastly, if I may, you know, you're a high-powered litigator at a Wall Street law firm, a partner, and you're doing pro bono work here for people who are often unseen and unheard. How essential is this type of civil litigation?
I think it's critically essential. It's conditions of confinement in civil cases on behalf of people in custody is something that I have done since I graduated from law school. And my view of it is I think that lawyers are asked to do pro bono services because there's a recognition that we are a key access point to the court. And the courts are where people go to prosecute and defend their rights. And if we are sort of gatekeepers of those courts, which in reality we are, I think, you know, most people would acknowledge, including all litigators, that courts can be exceedingly difficult to navigate or at least successfully navigate without a lawyer. If we're those gatekeepers, then it's incumbent on us to not limit our services to just those people who can pay. And so I have always focused in the universe of pro bono, who are the people who will have the most trouble accessing the courts to defend or prosecute their rights? And people in custody are, I think, in sort of the broader conversation, not always thought to be sort of a sympathetic group in a particular way, because often they have committed crimes. And I think they're not always thought to be an underrepresented group from a attorney perspective, because the Constitution provides the right to criminal defense, but it does not provide a right to counsel with respect to civil claims related to conditions of confinement. And so there is this sort of unique vacuum with this group of people who is not always viewed, you know, sympathetically by society. The abuses that are happening within the prison walls are definitionally happening outside of the purview of all but an extremely small group of people. And their ability to access counsel is extremely limited. They're not often not going to have money to bring a case. They are not going to have access to lawyers who know how to do it. And there's often sort of language, education, health barriers to sort of having the presence of mind to you know, pursue these rights. So when I think about it, I think I am trying to contribute to the strength of our justice system and the fairness of our justice system. And so I focus on who are the people most likely to have something bad happen to them and not be able to defend their rights. And this group is, for me, sort of definitionally that. And so I think about it as it's important to defend rights because we have a democracy and it's strongest when it's robust and equal. And so that's what I like to focus on.
Good. Well, Catherine, thank you very, very much, not just for taking the time today to talk about the work you're doing, but for doing that work and for having such a positive impact on so many people who otherwise, you know, are not seen or not heard and who are critically in need of that access to basic medical care. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. And thank you for your interest in the case. And it's been really fun to talk about it.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Law, Policy, and Markets, Milbank Conversations. Follow us on your favorite podcast platform and learn more at milbank.com.